Hello and welcome to Cafecito Break. I'm your host, Rosangel Perez, one of the Perez sisters. And with me today is Dr. Michael Schwartz. He's written a book called Fauci's Fiction. And, you know, this is a very appropriate conversation to have. It's almost 4 years. Actually, it's 4 years ago that we went into lockdown. And the world has not been the same since. I know that it's March 2024, and there's a whole large population of folks that don't want to remember COVID. They want to forget that COVID happened, but we can't, because what happened in 2020 and everything that unfolded after that has definitely impacted everyone, every single one of our lives globally. And we are still, unfortunately, seeing so much of that impact today. And then another thing is that we don't want to repeat. We need to be vigilant citizens and sort of like look at the signs and also talk as a community about what's happening. And so with me today is Dr. Michael Schwartz. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much. So if you can let the Cafecito Break community know what brought you to this fight, share a little bit of your background and what brought you to writing the book, Fauci's Fiction.
Sure. Well, I'm a research doctor, not a medical doctor. So I analyze data, but I also own a couple medical clinics. So I found myself at kind of the right crossroads when COVID started. And you're absolutely right. It was 4 years ago this week. In fact, the first day we started testing was March 16th of 2020. And we were the very first company in New Jersey to start testing for COVID. So kind of like everybody else, you know, we went out the door a little nervous, PPE'd up, you know, testing people on their front porch, not sure what was going on. But we started to see trends right away that were differing from what you heard in the mainstream media. And that didn't happen right away. It took a week, then 2 weeks, then a month in, 2 months in. And the book that I wrote, Fauci's Fiction, it's not about Dr. Fauci. In fact, it has nothing to do with him specifically, but the data does. The data in here, he gets the brunt of the cover because he was the guy on TV. He was the one who everyone associates with COVID for Dr. Birx and Dr. Walensky at the CDC. Fauci takes the cake. So he gets the brunt of the cover, and the data doesn't make them look so good when you analyze it. But that took a long time, and the book really, I kind of started writing it the day we started testing, because in my head, you're seeing these trends and developing a narrative, and I would have gotten the book out a lot sooner, but we were pretty busy. So COVID disrupted a lot of lives.
So right off the bat, how were you in the position of being one of the first companies to have access to do these kind of tests?
Great question. So we do something what's called a respiratory pathogen panel. We practice good medicine. A lot of times when you go to the doctor and you're not feeling well, they'll do a rapid strep, a rapid flu, and then you're out the door. Most doctors get about 7 minutes with a patient. We were doing something, I don't want to say unique in the industry, but a lot different than most doctors who rush you through. We care about our patients. We want to analyze things, and we want to diagnose things appropriately. So if you had come to our office 5 years before COVID existed, you were going to get swabbed. I like to say my patients knew what COVID swabs were long before COVID existed. One of the labs that we used at the time was one of the first 30 in the nation to get FDA approval to do COVID testing. So as the world stopped and came to a halt, much so did our office at the time, that lab called me and said, hey, we got FDA approval to do COVID testing. Do you guys want to take part? And we were like, yeah, we got nothing else to do. Why not? So we kind of fell into it by happenstance. And the first day we were legally allowed to test, which was March 16th of 2020, we did our first four tests and then accumulated 19,000 patients and did 44,000 tests in the 3 years that followed.
Now the PCR tests. So here, for a clarification's sake, is this the same as what is considered a PCR test, what you're indicating?
Correct.
Okay. And a lot of the controversy that I was coming across in terms of PCR testing is that it didn't seem like it was an appropriate method to test for to check if somebody had COVID. Can you enlighten us some more on sure. those details, since you were boots on the ground?
Yeah, I've had this question many times, and it frustrates me because people like to go down rabbit holes. And if they understood the data as I saw it when I was doing this in real time, PCR testing is the only appropriate way to test for COVID, period. We've been using PCR testing for years prior to COVID, and there are 31 different things on my respiratory pathogen panel. There's flu A, there's flu B, there's flu C, parainfluenza 1, 2, 3, 4, going all the way down to bacterial infections, and then finally a fungal infection. To diagnose that, you have to use PCR testing. PCR, this is a great question because you get a little into the science here. You want me to explain how testing works because it'll make a little bit more sense.
Yes, and because we have a community that does even include doctors and people who really dove deeply into this topic. And I am full aware that not everybody agrees, but we need to start the conversation. And this is an area where I specifically haven't really dove into with this precision.
Yeah. And I get tired of no offense to you, I'm tired of answering the question because we spend so much time on the validity of PCR testing that everybody misses the big picture. And I can tell you why it works and can tell you how it works. But first, let me tell you how it works. PCR testing, it amplifies a signal. Okay. And the sensitivity of PCR testing isn't linear. It's logarithmic. So it doesn't go 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. It goes 1, then 10, then 100 times the sensitivity, 1,000, 10,000, 100,000, million, 10 million, so on, all the way to level 36. Now, the hypothesis that you hear all the time is that you can find anything on a PCR test at any time. Well, I did 44,000 tests and I had 4,000 positive patients. Okay. In the hypothesis that these people would come up with, and they tell you can find anything on a PCR test. You remember I had 40,000 negative tests. So in the hypothesis that they talk about, you would have found something on those other 40,000 tests where you find nothing. If you stop the PCR testing at what's called a cycle threshold or a CT value that makes laboratory sense. And also, by the way, these labs that I've worked with, we've been working with them. They're reputable labs. We've been working with them for years. We don't use LabCorp. We don't use Quest. These are labs that I trust the PhDs there. We've been using them for years before COVID to diagnose anything from the flu. I get a sick patient who comes in the door. They obviously have something, right? We swab them. It goes off to the lab because you got to remember before COVID existed, there's something what you call a medical necessity. So before COVID existed, before the CARES Act existed and the emergency order, you had to have a medical necessity in order to get tested. So if you came in with one of three things, cough, fever, or shortness of breath, you have symptoms, you have an immune response that's fighting something off. I swab you, it goes out the door. And before COVID existed, I can tell if you have a coronavirus, there's 7 we test for. If you have flu A, if you have Moroxella catarrhalis, Klebsiella pneumonia, we know how to treat it once we diagnose it appropriately. COVID, as I said when this first thing started, was COVID's going to be just another thing that's on my panel at some point in the next couple of years. And now it is. I mean, we made a lot of predictions very early on that all came true, which is all in the book, if somebody wants to actually pay attention and read it. But we fight these battles with people who don't understand how testing works. Now, in contrast, a rapid antigen test, a rapid test, a home test that you would call it, you need 10 to the 6th to 10 to the 9th power of virus, okay? So instead of 9 copies at level 36 is what I need on a PCR test. And by the way, 9 copies is all I need at that highest level to tell me it's in your system, it's bound, and it's replicating. But what we've learned from doing mass testing, when you didn't need a medical necessity, this is what the emergency order did. It allowed me to test anybody at any time, anywhere. You found a lot of asymptomatic cases, which is why a lot of people said, oh, PCR testing isn't appropriate. No, no, no. I can tell you 100% of the time because I can repeat the data. In other words, I could take the same 100 patients. You could come up positive today against 99 negatives. I could mix up those samples tomorrow. I could retest all of you again tomorrow, and you would still come up positive tomorrow when all the other ones would come up negative again. So I could repeat the data over and over and over to assure the validity of the PCR testing at the labs that we were working with. Unless you see the data every day, it's like people coming to me and telling me, hey, they want to tell you how to do your job. And I always tell them, I don't show up at your job and tell you how to flip the burgers. When you see as much data as I do in real time with real patients who are sick and who are some asymptomatic, this is an important caveat. Most people don't understand what the word asymptomatic means. When you talk about symptoms, symptoms are not just observable. Sometimes they're only reportable. And what I mean by that is if you come in with a cough and I take your temperature and you have a fever and you're having a hard time breathing, I could observe that symptom. The most common symptom of COVID is a headache, and it has to do with hemoglobin uptake issues. And we learned that very early on from white paper out of Germany. Now, if somebody doesn't understand that, and they're expecting the cough, the fever. I got to go on a ventilator soon because they're watching the news and I'm going to die from this thing. That's what they were thinking in their head. And they don't understand it's a cough and a headache and fatigue. It might take me a half hour into the conversation with the patient before they go, you know, I have been having a ton of headaches lately. And they don't associate the symptomology with what's the most common in COVID. I can tell you that anybody through our data that came in between a level 27 and 36, asymptomatic or mild. Okay. Now, those symptoms can wax and wane. So that same person who was asymptomatic today, positive, I could test him 2 days later and that signal will go up. In other words, down, because if the number goes down, that means it's the higher viral load. Okay. So if you're detecting at a level 18 or 19, you have a high viral load. If you're detecting at a level 27 to 36, you have a very small viral load and your body is fighting it off. What we learned through this exercise, if we want to learn and move forward into the 21st, 22nd century and really talk about medicine, is that most people are fighting something off all the time, but your body is robust enough, your immune system is robust enough that you're fighting these things off. The sickest of the sick during COVID had what's called a co-infection. Now, you would never know that unless you were doing a full respiratory pathogen like we were. So when you were sick, cough, fever, whatever you had, my swabs going off to the lab, a lot of times people would come back with COVID, most commonly, and staph. That was the most common secondary infection. I had a guy 3 years ago who came back with COVID, staph, H flu, and RSV all at the same time. He would have never known he had all that stuff. That's very uncommon to see. I also had a woman come back with COVID and the flu at the same time, which is also very uncommon, but it does happen occasionally. So you have to understand what you're treating, but PCR testing is the only way to do that. On a rapid test, because I need 10 to the 6th to 10 to the 9th power of virus, I need so much virus on a rapid test that if you come back positive on a rapid, you are definitely positive for something, because a rapid test can come back positive for any coronavirus, including the common cold. But a negative tells me even less, because you need so much more virus on a rapid test to come back positive that a lot of negatives on a rapid test would absolutely come back positive on a PCR test. You have to understand how testing works. People go down these rabbit holes, and like I said, it takes so much time away from getting to the real nitty gritty of what we need to talk about. And what people need to understand is that we've been using this forever. It works very well when you use reputable labs. And if you have somebody like me who's analyzing the data to make sure you care about the validity of the testing, not only for your labs, your office, and your patients, I think that's the most important. And again, I could repeat that data over and over and over to prove that point.
That's a great response, and I really appreciate being patient with us and all of us who keep asking you this question. I mean, I'm on the content creator side, and this has been my professional deep dive for, I don't want to give the number of years away, but I was calling people directly and getting people telling me I've taken tests and there were false positives. So where is the breakdown here, Dr. Shores? Is it that was it the labs? Is it all this conspiracy theory came from, that the PCR tests were faulty in relationship to COVID? I'm just asking.
Let's look at the data. So I had 4,000 positives out of my 19,000 patients out of 40,000 tests, 4,000 positives. About 85% of those were asymptomatic or mild. Okay. And if you define mild, and this is how we define mild as not needing hospitalization. Well, we only had 4 out of 4,000 patients go to the hospital. If you give me a sick person and I test them today, it's going to come up for something. At that time, it was most likely, as a matter of fact, today, it's most likely COVID. The flu's going around as well. But there's a million other things, as I mentioned, Roxella, Cataras, all this other stuff. You have to identify it appropriately. If you are getting tested by a reputable lab using a PCR test and you're positive, you are 100% positive. Just because you don't have a symptom, what I have to explain to people is that is the norm. So put yourself in my shoes, okay? You go to a kid's house who's very sick, all right? And he's coughing up a storm. He's got a fever, the whole nine yards. He's the only one with symptoms, but the whole family wants to be tested. So I test all 5 of them, okay? The kid comes back with COVID. The next day I test the other 4 of them because they're all begging for a test, even though they don't have a symptom. They're all positive as well, okay? Which makes sense because they're in the same household. And we saw this on 441 different occasions. If you were positive in the household, if somebody was positive in the household with symptoms, everyone in the house would have it 100% of the time. But about 85 to 90% of the time, they wouldn't develop classic symptoms. Again, getting into what understanding symptoms is. The mother would tell me she's got nothing. The father would have a bunch of headaches. The other son would have some diarrhea, but not a cough, fever, or shortness of breath. Most people were expecting to have these things that they saw on television to be put on a vent. That's not the case with COVID. And if you understand the data in total, COVID is not as deadly as everybody was talking about. And that's the biggest caveat we had to kind of figure out in the first 2 to 3 weeks of this thing. As everyone on TV is saying, lockdown, suicide rates are going up, keeping kids out of school. I'm telling the public, I'm starting to say, hold on a second. I'm testing everybody on the planet here. And most of these people are fine. And even if they do develop a symptom, which could turn into a classical symptom, like a cough, light cough, a fever, something like that, most of the time they would get over that in a day or two and they would recover just fine. So I'm sitting here watching my patients recover in real time, and they're asking me now, what do I do? Because they're expecting to go off to the hospital. By the way, a lot of people ran off to the hospital out of pure fear, not because they needed to. They didn't have pulse oxes that were too low. They weren't having problems breathing. They weren't having heart issues. They were just in fear of watching the television. The media was as culpable as the government here during this. That's why I wrote the title of the book, is how the media and modern medicine, government and modern medicine missed the boat on COVID from day one. They were putting people in such a panic that people were rushing off to the hospital. And everybody at that time wanted and was clamoring for a test. What you found was most people had it. Most people didn't have a classic symptom. If they did, they got over it in a couple days. And by the way, the regimen we use, Rob, was vitamin C, vitamin D, zinc, and electrolytes. We used that the entire time, and it worked pretty well. Then we got into things like proning and stuff like that. But everyone thought they needed something else, like, you know, ivermectin, or they needed, you know, hydroxychloroquine. The truth is, we never really used any of that stuff, and everybody recovered just fine. So what's the narrative here? The narrative here is that the media and the government blew this thing up to put people out of school, out of business, all these suicide rates going up. It's atrocious what they did to this country. But we knew that about a month into testing.
Okay, so let's go back to that time. You have a very interesting boots on the ground insight. And how is life for you at that moment? When did you have the pivotal moment that other people were more nervous about this? The media, local elected officials, the clients that are coming in to see you, than what you were actually experiencing and the way people were healing. When did that hit home for you?
It was a process. You know, you got to remember, we were the only ones out there. I was like on an island, right? So my phone is, once I let everybody know that I had COVID tests, all of a sudden the word got out and it was like, you could not get a COVID test. If you remember right early on, everybody was clamoring for tests and we were running out of supplies left and right. So it was kind of a process. It was like, you didn't know in the first week, and then you would see those patients who were sick recover. And then the next week you would notice that all your patients were recovering again. So then the third week you're testing, those patients are scared and they're asking you, like, you know, what are you seeing? Like, what are you hearing? I can only tell you what I saw in my first week, in my second week of patients. And I can tell you that, you know, they were fine. They recovered. Once the fever broke, it seemed like 2 days later. So you're learning week to week to week to week to week. So once you have that first month of testing, then you have the second month of testing. Now, keep in mind, my wife, my girlfriend at the time, she's an ICU trauma nurse. She's coming home from the hospital and she's telling everybody doom and gloom stories. Like, she's telling me, you don't see the people I'm putting in body bags. I'm telling her, I'm saying, you don't see what I'm seeing. I'm at people's homes testing them and they're sick, but they're fine in like 2 or 3 days. And like, all my patients are fine. Nobody's going to the hospital. Nobody's dying. So like, you don't see what I'm seeing. You got to remember something. By definition, sick people go to the hospital, right? So, you know, I'm testing folks on the street who have a little cough, a fever, or whatever. And then, of course, they're scared and they want to test. You're not seeing the sickest of the sick. You're not seeing the 85-year-old elderly person. And you got to put this in perspective. If you're in the pool of population that can die in the next 5 years, a cold can bring you down, a flu can bring you down, COVID can bring you down, RSV. There's a lot of stuff out there that can bring you down if you are an unhealthy elderly person at the end of life. And we saw that. And we were out, you got to remember something. We were doing nursing homes, school districts, police departments. A lot of times after a couple of weeks, we had a lot of clients call us up and say, can you come in and do weekly testing? So I have something that's really unique in the industry that nobody else in the country really has. It's called horizontal data. That's where you test the exact same population every single week for 3 years. We did that with a lot of police departments and municipalities and nursing homes. So I have horizontal data on people that it really paints a different picture when you look at it. So if you take 100 cops and test them every single week, I can tell you out of those 100 cops how often they had COVID over 3 years, how often they were symptomatic over those 3 years, what their CT value was over those 3 years, if they had a co-infection with it over those 3 years. There's a lot of data when it comes to COVID versus just negative or positive, but people don't understand that. So then you get into the minutia of like PCR testing. And I honestly think that's a real distraction to get people to go down a different path. Because if you, like I said, I can repeat the data over and over and over. And this happened. I mentioned the kid and the parents. I had a cop once who we tested at work, and they were taking these people out of work. And his name is Brian. I'm not giving any information, his last name out, but I can say that now. And Brian gets tested and Brian came back positive. Well, Brian's pissed off because he's missing work and his police chief's taking him out of work and he's got no symptoms. So he wants to know if he can come in the next day for a confirmatory test. Sure, no problem. So he comes in the next day, gets another test. Well, guess what? I call him again and said, you're positive. Okay. They don't want to believe this. Then a week later, he sneaks in to one of my testing centers because I see his name pop up. And you got to remember, we test 100 people. I might get one or two or three positives. Well, he's one of the one or two or three. And I'm calling him up saying, why are you continuing to test? You can test positive for up to 90 days on a PCR test. It means nothing. Once you get it and you have it, the virus can only sustain in your system for 10 days. At that point, after you do your isolation period, you are no longer symptomatic, okay? And the majority of people who are asymptomatic really don't spread COVID in the first place unless you're in the same household, which is what we saw in that 441 home experiment. 100% of the time, if you're in a home with somebody who's symptomatic, everybody has it. But if you're walking past somebody in a grocery store, you're not going to give them COVID. You really got to be in close confines in order to spread it asymptomatically. That's one thing that the WHO got correct in this thing, was that asymptomatic spread was virtually zero. Now, I don't trust the WHO. I don't trust the CDC. They screwed the kid in the caboodle on this one. They really screwed this up. Dr. Fauci, Dr. Birx, these folks that what we saw so early on could have prevented this exercise that we went through. But nobody wanted to listen to what we were saying. They didn't want to listen to the practitioners on the ground who were doing this, analyzing the data. They were hypothesizing and getting information from God knows where, because it seemed like there was a narrative. Now, I don't talk about politics in the book. I just give the data. But if you read the data and understand it as I understand it, you'll understand that that narrative was definitely there, and they absolutely exploited something. We don't have to get into it, but it's right in front of you if you just analyze the data.
You know, the whole madness around all of the testing and swabbing definitely put a lot of people off. People like me turned down jobs that required it. It just seemed obsessive. So listening to you, I mean, I wish I would have had learned about you those days, right? Because I see how you would have been a voice of reason and a voice of calming people down during that madness. I was having fights with people both on camera and outside of it because they were telling me COVID doesn't exist. And I'm like, I'm in New York City. Something is actually really happening. I don't know. People are dying. I don't know why, but it's really happening. So there was a bombardment of everybody seemed to be having a different experience than there's whatever we were seeing on TV, right? If you lived in a certain part of the country, some people didn't know anybody at a certain point that even had this or that was sick. So then they were looking at people like me that would leave the house and would learn about yet another person that passed away. Like, no, this is conspiracy theory. Those aren't really, those are not body bags. That's fake news. And it was really confusing. I mean, I can't understand why people got angry at media and even alternative media, because we took things sometimes and we ran with it and we really didn't do the whole picture, right? It became a lot of pointing fingers and you got this wrong and you didn't get that wrong. But we didn't do what I saw that happened after 9/11, which was people were trying to figure out what happened, and we came together as a community to support one another, lift one another up. What can I do for you? We were neighborly. This thing was like
doors apart,
social distancing, people welcome each other with elbows instead of hugs and kisses.
Well, let's talk about about
from
that.
Your perspective, was all of this testing necessary when people and like businesses and government, however, whoever was pushing this out? Because goodness gracious, at one point when it was left off to the businesses to make decisions, like I was just kind of surprised where people kind of drew the line.
There's a lot to unpack there in what you said. COVID is very real. COVID is not the flu. The flu is an orthomyxoviridae. COVID is a coronavirus. They're very two different and distinct things. People like to talk about that. Oh, COVID's the, no, it's not. And they don't understand virology and they don't understand science. Was all the testing necessary? No, absolutely not. If you're sick, you should go to a reputable practitioner like ourselves to get a respiratory pathogen panel so that you understand what you have and it's properly diagnosed rather than just doing a rapid flu or a rapid strep. That's stupid. Your doctor's doing you a disservice by doing that because they have no idea what they're treating. And if you have a bacterial infection that's untreated that you need treatment for, it can get out of control. So if you're sick, get tested. What the mass testing did though, was it gave us an insight. It was once in a lifetime. I don't agree with it, but you have to take the data that we got during it to jump into the 22nd century, as I was mentioning before, to understand medicine. We could really transform the way we look at respiratory pathogens and treatment if we look at the data and analyze it and have a frank discussion, but we're not doing that. People want to talk about, you know, PCR testing or is COVID real or, you know, I'm so tired. We really have an opportunity from the mass testing that we did. My friend Mike, my co-host on my show, Two Mikes Live, he's proud of the fact that he never got a test. Now, okay, that's just prideful and stupid. And I've told him that to his face. It leads you down a road of stupidity. Because if you're not feeling well and you're sick, information is power. So getting a test or a full panel test like we do to analyze it, to have that information moving forward makes a lot of sense for your own knowledge to figure out what you have and how to treat it. Look, I had COVID in late January of 2020 before we were testing. I didn't know that because we didn't have testing available. But as I treated enough patients, I realized what I had was COVID. I had 4 weeks of a cough. I couldn't taste or smell. I had all the, you know, all these things I was seeing in patients, it made the most sense. But what that gave me was an 18-month window of immunity. And that's what we saw, by the way, in the first 18 to 19 months. I did not have a repeat patient get COVID again for 18 to 19 months, which tells you another thing. You got to remember, I'm testing people weekly. Okay. Remember that weekly. Now the hypothesis that these people say that PCR testing doesn't work, well, I would have gotten them positive every single week. We did not see a repeat for 18 to 19 months, including myself. So I had a lot of B and T cell immunity at that point, which protected me while I was out testing these folks, but information is power. Now, the second time I caught COVID again 2 months later. Now that tells you something. That tells you that the mutations were vast. They were vastly different than we had in the early L strain and the S strain. This is when the Omicron came out and the body wasn't recognizing it. This tells you that it came from a singular point, which points back to a lab leak theory, not a zoonotic theory. There's a lot of science to unpack when you really delve into it. So was the amount of testing necessary? No, but the amount of testing that we did is what was able to prove what's in here to go against what everybody else was saying on there on the TV. So by doing 44,000 tests, you can't dispute the data. It doesn't lie. If you want to say, you could say whatever you want on TV. You can say whatever you want about the vaccines. Guess what? I have information on that. We have data on antibodies post-vaccine. We have information on antibodies post-natural infection, how long they last. Guess what? It's the same. It's 120 days. We can tell you that there's a report that came out today that most of the people who are dying now in hospitals are fully vaccinated people. And we predicted that very early on because we see issues with the vaccines, which actually flare up areas of instability. If somebody's got a heart issue, you're going to see it's the woman who would have a heart issue at 70. It's now coming out at 40. It's the person who would have a joint issue at 40. Now it's coming out at 20. There's reasons behind all these things. These aren't just blanket statements. These are things we've measured. We have metrics in our office and we can prove. And that's why it is important to do some of the testing. If we didn't do that, I would have never been able to understand what COVID was in its totality. I would have never been able to write that book.
You've definitely have, you know, I'm glad that people like you exist because I have always been kind of afraid to go to the doctor. And this experience onward made it almost hellish. Like, you know, many of us had loved ones that we were visiting in the hospital. And like my uncle, he wanted me to bring him chicken soup, and he was we knew that he didn't have much life in him, right? Not that I was trying to be so dire, but we just knew. And I couldn't get up there to see him because the only, either I showed proof that I had a test or a vaccination. And there was no way, no one I can talk to. There I was with my little chicken soup, and I wasn't able to even go upstairs. And when I did have an opportunity to speak to, I guess, a nurse that was on his floor, she was nasty. She was patronizing. And I came very close to calling her an a-hole. And I realized that I had more updated information of the CDC and what was happening than she did. Because at that point, masks weren't required anymore. So it was just sort of this thing where I'm like, why isn't the hospital systems, for example, catching up with what these systems that I don't even trust are saying anyway? And again, speaking to you at this point and understanding what you just said about, all the testing wasn't necessary, but now we have this data that these people cannot refute. It's irrefutable. And so I'm grateful that you put this book together, and I really recommend that people check it out and learn more. So now you're at a point where you're starting to see the disconnects. I saw in an interview that you did previously that you were trying to reach out to your local community, politicians, for example, to sort of let them know your findings. How did that go?
Politicians typically go whichever way the wind goes. You know, as a populist person, most politicians care about their constituents and get reelected. First of all, we never required masks in our office. The masking was the second dumbest thing I've ever seen in my career. We do not wear surgical masks for virions. We just don't do it. It's stupid. So we'd have people coming into our own office saying, why aren't you guys wearing masks? And we're like, because we're not morons. And again, I don't come to your job and tell you how to flip the burgers, right? So let me do mine and maybe we can have a discussion. These politicians would say, well, I understand that, but you know, I'm not going to push back against the mask because, you know, if people want to wear them, why are we perpetuating stupidity? You know, that was always my question. If we just came out early on in the first 2, 3, 4 weeks and explained to people the basics of COVID, we could have avoided this exercise that hurt a lot more people in 3 years. People to this day still don't understand the difference between isolation and quarantine. It drives me insane because language is important. And when you control the language, you control the narrative. But if you are in a worldwide pandemic that everyone could die from, you know, I feel like Richard Nixon when I do that, you best get on the same page with language. How long a virus stays in your system? What I mentioned before, 10 days. What the incubation period is, 3 to 5 days. There's important reasons for that, because if you understand timelines and how viruses transmit, how masks work, or better yet, don't work, most of the people wearing the masks were the ones coming in with the staph infections. They were giving themselves a secondary infection because they're breeding a warm, moist environment. So we did not ever require a mask in our office. It's, again, the second dumbest thing I've ever seen in my career. There's a lot to COVID that we really should have explained very early on, but we neglected to do so as a society. Now, I was out there telling my patients, and yes, I was trying to tell politicians, and yes, I was doing some radio programs, but not to the point where I was on a media tour for a book. And, you know, I might be on, you know, the radio once or twice a week, and the host would ask me questions, and I'd tell them exactly what we saw. And they would go, well, that's not what we're hearing on TV. And they would look at you like you were a crackpot. Now, meanwhile, a year later, the news would say exactly what I was saying a year prior and catch up to us. And that was very frustrating because we're, you know, kind of like, I feel like I'm wasting my time. Our patients were very well informed. Our patients were very well educated as to COVID. And even the folks that we worked for, like the police departments where we were doing weekly testing, I'd have the people ask me, is this necessary? Do we need to do? No, it's not. You know, but they'd want to still do testing to figure out, and fine, we'll come in and conduct it because that's the only way to properly mitigate it. But they'd ask me about masks. No, it's stupid. Why would you wear a mask? By the way, remember those 6-foot things on the, you know, airport, wherever? I quote Dr. Lydia Baruba in my book. She's from MIT, and she did a study on breathing in a room. Particle size and air fluidity is important. 27.2 feet was the spread that she got just breathing in a room, okay? 6 foot was a made-up number. The wearing a mask or a face covering was made up to make people feel like they were doing something and mitigating something. I think the, and I look, and by the way, I say in my book that half the country has an IQ of less than 100, and this is the problem we're dealing with, you know, the ramifications of those folks. But I think the public is smart enough that if you can sit them down and give them the facts, that everybody could kind of, you know, calm down and quell this thing. When you talked about your uncle and going with the soup, I watched more birthday parties from afar when I was in nursing homes doing testing, where, you know, Mildred, who was 90, who turning 90 that day, her family was outside in the cold, you know, through the glass, looking at Mildred, you know, with a cake doing a birthday. And then Mildred would die 6 months later because she was old, not from COVID. That's sad that we separated families. My friend Mike's father died, and they couldn't attend the funeral because of the stupid rules that we had in New Jersey. That's not fair. And that's not fair coming from a governor who's getting directives from a CDC who doesn't come out with the truth on this thing. We didn't need to do that. It was completely unnecessary. And we destroyed a lot of lives. And you said in the beginning of the show that we're not talking about it anymore because people are tired of COVID. That's the wrong approach. They destroyed our lives for 3 years when we knew this in 2020 and could have avoided this. So we need to have a nationwide discussion, a worldwide discussion on this, and get to the bottom of it. And when I say the bottom of it, there are people that are culpable. There are people that led you down the wrong road. If everybody in the country would just take the time, and by the way, my book's 170 pages, you could do it in 3 hours. If everybody in the country would read that for 3 hours, we'd all be on the same page, at least as a start. And then we could start talking about what we're seeing now, because my second book's coming out in June, and that's called Vaccine Fiction. That is a follow-up to this, because what we did with the vaccines was the first dumbest thing I have ever seen in my career, and it is destroying lives. The amount of issues that we're getting back from vaccine-related injuries is incredible. It will blow your mind when you see the data, and you have to understand how the data is being reported to know that you're not hearing the entire picture yet. And you will at some point, but by that point, it may be too late.
Wow. I would hate to see what that data is, because just the amount of information that I'm coming across is pretty dire. And you know, the reason why maybe I've spent, and many of us have cried so much, right? It's beyond what a person goes through and whatever we went through personally. I want to take this moment to read this testimonial, because then I'm going to follow it up really quickly with a question about censorship and the vaccines. So this was my testimonial, community members. I'm a Cafecito Break. Twitter and Instagram took us down 10 times in 2 months. I wonder why. So this is my testimonial. 4 years ago was the last week before we went into the new normal that has forever changed all of our lives. It seems like a different time, another life. A mountain of disasters, one after the other, since then. Back in 2020, the Perez sisters spoke out and questioned the narrative propagandas that politicians, Fauci, and the media pushed, for examples. Because we were boots on the ground, people started sending us messages and videos with information that challenged the daily rhetoric that we were hearing. These were either first-hand accounts or messages from doctors who were making other discoveries and were also trying to share their findings on social media. When we realized that doctors were getting censored, things started feeling and looking even more suspicious. We hit the streets to learn for ourselves, interviewed folks who were boots on the ground and had other insights that people needed and wanted to hear. But the censorship got crazy with all of us, right? So things that I start diving into in this testimonial is just sort of explaining the different kinds of censorship that started to happen to people who were sharing things, like either you were losing accounts or you were getting shadow banned, which means that you're still putting the information out there, but people aren't really seeing it. Or sometimes you post something and it's on a delay and people may see it a couple of days later. Sometimes we would live stream, the audio would get stripped. So you are still thinking you're live streaming, and all of a sudden you have almost no views and you wonder why. It's because somebody like Facebook or YouTube, or they stripped the audio so that you can't communicate. And so when there are people who I've spoken to who missed a lot of these details that were unfolding along the way since 2020, Dr. Mike. And one of the things that some of them are saying now is, how come you guys who were so close to this information didn't warn us?
Well, I'll tell you today, the biggest culprits for me are Meta, which is Facebook and Instagram, and YouTube. I do an interview like this. I remember doing my first one out of the UK, and the two hosts that I was doing it with in England came on and said, we just got pulled off of YouTube and then another platform within 5 minutes. And we weren't talking about anything controversial. We were talking about the science of how PCR testing and how antigen testing works. Okay. How is that controversial? It got pulled off immediately. I was on another interview in Virginia, and I was talking to her about that story. And she goes, well, it's funny you said that, because we just got pulled off. I was on Rumble the other day. Rumble's the only free speech platform as I'm aware of. But we were doing a show the other day, and it froze right in the middle. So every time something freezes, even though it's a decent platform, we go, is it like the bots that are noticing this stuff? It's kind of incredible. I told you off air that Amazon, my book is on TutorStreet, Amazon and Ingram Sparks. You can get it anywhere you want. The problem is finding it. Now, what a lot of people do, and a lot of authors that are new, they'll go out and they'll promote. They'll spend money to promote their book. So when you go to Amazon, you ever search for something and you see something else pop up ahead of what you search for and it says sponsored, that's somebody spending money to sponsor their product. I can't spend money on Amazon due to what they said was current events. Now, I didn't know what that meant until about 3 weeks ago. Jim Jordan and his Judiciary Committee at the United States House of Congress uncovered emails from the White House to Amazon asking them to censor books on COVID and vaccines. So the White House asked this. Amazon pushed back initially, and then they finally complied from under pressure from the White House. So now I know why I can't push my book on Amazon, but that's one thing. Now, if they uncovered emails from the White House to Amazon, where else do you think there's collusion going on? I mean, obviously Meta, because I see it. I could put a picture of my big toe on Facebook and get 500 likes. But if I put a picture or a link to this book, guess what? Two people see it, if that, and that's people scrolling through my page. So it's obvious. It's right in front of you. We were trying to tell people the truth. We were trying to get the message out there, where it was obviously a government conspiracy. And I hate to say that word, and I've never been a conspiracy theorist. And until those emails came out and proved that there was a conspiracy, I've never said that. There was a government conspiracy, a government operation here to censor people like us who had a different narrative than what the CDC wanted you to hear. And most doctors out there, you got to keep this in mind, by the way, when COVID started and I was the only guy on the street testing, most doctors that we knew, they shut their doors. They weren't testing for COVID. They closed up shop and went home out of fear that they might bring this home to their family. And that's fine for them, not for me. I'm a little bit different. We want to try and help people and do the right thing. By the way, that's when the public needed those doctors most. But now those same doctors who didn't do what I did and didn't see what I saw and don't have any data, nothing, are out there giving advice to maybe get a vaccine because you're of this certain age group or comorbidity. By the way, those are the last people I would ever give a vaccine to, because that's probably the thing that's going to give them over the edge. I'm gonna be very clear. We did not recommend a vaccine because we thought there would be issues from the vaccines. We didn't recommend the vaccine for two reasons. One, they don't work. They give you 120-day antibody response. Two, you didn't need it. Keep yourself in mind, my shoes here, 4,000 positive patients, didn't lose one, four went to the hospital, recovered fine. If any of my patient group came to me when these vaccines came out a year later and said, do I need a vaccine? The answer was a laughable no. All my patients are fine. Why would I give you something experimental to put in your body for something that you don't need and two, doesn't work? So the answer was no. We didn't now because, and I'm glad we gave that answer because that was just a smart, logical answer. Now that we're seeing issues coming back from these mRNA shots, I am so glad we didn't recommend these things. And a 65-year-old with comorbidities is the last person I'd give this thing to because it flares up areas of instability. So the CDC narrative that's out there, and again, the doctors who are going, you know, hook, line, and sinker, they're just toeing the line for the CDC. do not have the same experience that my company does. Where else are they going to get their, you know, when their patients come to them and say, do I need this thing? They just look at what the CDC recommends and say, yeah, the CDC says, well, maybe you should ask your doctor the next time you see him. Based on what? How much knowledge do you have? How much experience do you have with COVID to be giving me this answer? Because if your doctor is giving you erroneous information based on speculation from the CDC, you should probably fire that doctor. That doctor doesn't give a crap about you. That doctor is probably the one doing the rapid flu and the rapid strep every time you're sick in there and giving you 7 minutes because they got to overbook so that they can make enough money for the day because insurance doesn't pay, which is why you get 7 minutes with a doctor and you have to wait an hour and a half when you go to that office. My office would never do that to a person. We respect people's time, but we respect their health. And we also respect our integrity. So if somebody's going to ask us a question based on COVID, we're going to give you an answer because we got a lot of experience. But if you come to my primary care office and ask me a question about cancer or cardiology, we're going to send you somewhere else because we don't do that for a living. And maybe these doctors should have just stayed in their lane the entire time and the world would be a much better place right now. It's unfathomable to me that we went down this road and that we have professionals towing the line when we have data to prove otherwise in this entire exercise. It blows my mind.
It blows my mind too, Dr. Mike. When Joe Biden came into presidency, and I did not vote for him, not that I'm trying to make this political, but the reason I didn't vote for Biden community members is because I was studying, and I knew that the moment this man got into office, that he would start mandating vaccines. And that is exactly what happened. And for people like me, whose whole life career has been media, and I'm studying the data, and I'm covering this story just about every single day and getting thrown off all these platforms and getting strikes. Do you know that I got a strike and a video removal because I covered a actual news story in which the topic was the doctor treats patients maskless. Mm-hmm. That was bad.
Well, we treat everybody.
I wasn't a doctor, but yet I'm reading a story. So I'm like, okay, but wait, but now you're kind of gaslighting people here because this is still a story that I'm in media. I'm covering something by someone who's a doctor who is treating patients who has a history of this. Nobody's getting sick and he's doing it without a mask because of some of the reasons that you were explaining just a few moments ago. And everybody went down with the ship. That guy, I think, might have lost his medical license, I think. And I lost my video. I wasn't able to go live for a week. And as you know, that slows down your momentum. The algorithm buries you. And so when people are like, how come you're not a bigger channel, Cafecito Break? Because we have been with the doctors getting censored left and right. Not that we weren't already censored before 2020, but this amplified the whole game. And, you know, I push the edges on media, but I don't get crazy, right? To the point where there's people who lose their channels or whatever, and we can understand why, right? You're pushing things that may not be, that may be harming people in different ways. I can get it. But this was us trying to deliver information. It just almost seemed like the game of journalism got toppled upside down and people were either coerced or peer pressured, because that's the other thing. I know people who worked in either a big media company or a big newspaper company or maybe like a big cable company. I'm not naming them because I'm not trying to slander anyone. But these members that work in these companies were giving me insights, and a lot of them felt pressured not to even say or even like communicate how they were feeling. It was like, of course you're getting tested, right? Or which vaccine did you take? Like literally, Dr. Mike, I joined a Zoom session one time that had nothing to do with this. It was just really different. It was like, it had to do with real estate. And as I'm joining the Zoom session, there's like five people talking. They're all having a conversation about the vaccine that they just took and which one this one took and this one. It was like, oh my God, but mine didn't get me like sick. And I was hoping that I would get sick so I could have like two weeks at home. I'm like, what are these idiots? Like, And I stayed quiet. I didn't say anything because, of course, I wasn't there for that. It wasn't political. It had to do with real estate, right? But this is part of the mind conditioning, the programming that the media, the mainstream media, propagandists were spreading on the people, and it just hurt the community. And to this day, March 2024, community members, we are still having this fight. Family members and community members and colleagues are not gathering together. This is still a taboo subject. What's not taboo is that our family members are dying. Our friends are dying. What's not taboo is the mental illness that we're experiencing, the depression, the people being afraid, the social anxieties. You know, that is what keeps me up. That is what makes me hurt, because we talk about us being censored, but one of the people, and forgive my passion, I am almost at the
oh, I appreciate
verge
it.
Of tears, because it just infuriates me, it angers me. But some of the people that are even more sensitive than you and I are the people that actually are vaccine injured, because they try to tell their stories and nobody believes them, or it's too hot for any algorithm to be on.
Well, it's also the way it gets reported. You know, that's a topic in my second book and how VAERS works. And we've worked with some people who have extensive research with VAERS. And the stories you hear will blow your mind. When you have to understand, data is important, right? Because when you hear a story, the news is going to want to go verify data, if the news does their job anymore. They want to go verify data. So they're going to go to VAERS and pull that out and say, okay, well, if VAERS is the only place for this data to occur, you have to understand how VAERS works. Most of those people who are having those problems, those issues will never get reported to VAERS. My staff doesn't know how to report to VAERS. No doctor that I know has ever reported anything to VAERS. And it's a cumbersome process. It's not as easy as like the COVID numbers. When I do a test, right, with one of my labs, the lab that I use in San Antonio or in Virginia, they legally by law have to report those numbers to the state. So the next day, the state reports to the county, and you can see how many positive cases of COVID you have in the state and the county, and blah, 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 and so on and so on. And if you weren't doing that, those labs would get in so much trouble. They would get fined and all this stuff. So it was like imperative that they had to report these numbers. So the numbers you saw in the beginning for COVID were accurate, but the numbers you see on the VAERS system for these people that are having issues, it's minute. So the issues that these people are having, whether it's vaccine related or could be considered vaccine related, even if it's reported to VAERS, it's not considered vaccine related until the CDC does an investigation to put a tag on it and say, yeah, we think this is vaccine induced. But so many of those issues happen down the road. In other words, you know, it's not the day of the shot. It's not the day after the shot. It's 6 months later discovering you have a heart issue. It's a couple weeks later where you start to have joint problems, or you throw a clot. And they go, well, you know, you're older. We can't say it was from the vaccine. So those numbers never get into VAERS. And even if they do think it's vaccine induced, it'll still never get into VAERS. So what you see in VAERS is probably about 1% of what's out there. So if you take the number in VAERS today and multiply it by 100, that's probably a more accurate scenario of what is out in the United States. And people don't realize that. So I get it. I'm on your page, and while you're saying that, it reiterates the thought that we seriously need to have a very long discussion about what we went through so that everybody can be on the same page finally. Meanwhile, we're sitting back watching the Super Bowl and they're doing commercials for vaccines. For what? Did you get your booster today? Again, I didn't recommend these things from the start for the two reasons I gave you: don't work and don't need it. And 75% of the country, when these things came out, got fully vaccinated. Now the number's down to 17%. So most of the country has caught up to us as the news starts leaking out, or because in their own mind, they got the shot and they still caught COVID. Duh, we told them that was going to happen in the beginning. If they would have just let the folks on the ground speak, the public would have known that. I had so many patients that I would call, Rosie, to tell them that they were positive. And they would go, I don't understand how I'm positive. I'm fully vaccinated. And the same grouping of people in the first couple of months of testing were the same ones that were saying, I don't understand how I'm positive. I wore a mask the whole time. You just want to roll your eyes at these people. By the way, the masking thing, that's one of my favorites. You got to understand particle size. Particle size is very important. Anything less than 0.25 microns does not settle by gravity. Okay. And COVID is 0.1 micron. So I demonstrate that with my vape pen, because that's kind of what is going on with COVID, all right? They don't settle by gravity. your mask isn't duct taped to your face, okay? If it was duct taped to your face, we could have a conversation about filter size. Or if it was a properly fitted N95 mask, we could talk about filter size. No one talks about that. They just throw a blue surgical mask on and go, oh, I'm doing something. No, you're doing nothing. You're actually doing, you're making it worse by breeding that warm environment for a bacterial infection. It only takes one live particle to infect you. You could fit 500 million COVID particles on a pinhead. Think about that. So when you have somebody symptomatic in a room and they are breathing and you are walking around amongst 500 million to a billion particles circling you, and it only takes one live particle to infect you, that mask is doing absolutely zero. So we could have the conversation all day. What we talk about, look, science and common sense, all right? We can go down the list, whether it comes to vaccines, whether it comes to masks, whether it comes to how testing works. None of that, the basic stuff, should have been out there in that first month of testing. The first month of those lockdowns, forcing everybody to have all these issues now, years later, could have been mitigated. We could have avoided this entire exercise. I'll say it again, because the government and the media didn't want you to know the truth for whatever reason, whether it was ratings, whether it was a presidential election. And by the way, I didn't vote for Biden either. And I think if you did, I don't think your audience did, but if you did, your IQ is going to be in question here. Because if you look at logic and facts, I don't know how anybody in their right mind can vote for this set of policies.
Sleepy Joe has got to go, community members. You know, the whole masking thing was a big thing for me. You know, what was interesting in terms of timing, a few weeks before, you know, the country and in New York City, we locked down. My niece and I were watching a movie. You know, we have little dates and we love to watch movies. And we picked this movie that was like, I thought was like a romantic movie, but it was called 6 Feet Apart. Had nothing to do with COVID, but the whole premise was, if I'm not mistaken, and forgive me if it was either 5 feet apart or 6 feet apart, but if I'm not mistaken, so the whole thing is like, you see these two young people and they really love each other, but they can't really be near each other because if one of them becomes a contagion to the other one could die. So they loved each other, and I'm really doing a bad review here, folks, but my point is that the movie ends and I'm sobbing in tears and I'm looking at my niece and I'm like, that is a horrible experience to be communicating with people at such a distance that you love because you are afraid of contaminating them. I would never want to experience this. And then a few weeks later, we went into that madness. And you know, it's hard for the conspiracy theorist in me not to wonder about the timing of that movie, who created it, who named it, and why, even though it was not necessarily related to COVID, but just the idea of just having a certain distance that you must be in order to communicate with other community members. And now you have to mask. Did you have social distance ambassadors over by where you were, Dr. Mike?
Ambassadors.
Yes.
By the way, I do this because I do a live show. I'm used to doing what I do on my show. So I was looking it up. 5 Feet Apart, the movie, was released in 2019, in March of 2019. Good call on that. You can go check that out. And it's interesting. I'm helping you out here.
Thank you.
Ambassadors. I was in a Wawa once on the phone with a patient, and I was talking to a patient about her COVID results or something. And the woman behind the woman ringing me up behind the plexiglass, she had the mask on the whole nine yards, starts yelling at me that I was too close to the guy in front of me. And she's yelling, 6 feet, 6 feet. And the guy turns around, he left. I was so annoyed. Because as you've noticed, I stand up for myself. I pulled my mask down. I said, excuse me, do you know what the fuck I do for a living? I said, I test COVID patients and I'm on the phone with one of them right now. So shut the fuck up, do your job and leave me alone. Because you get really tired of people trying to tell you what they think. And again, I don't go to your job and tell you how to flip burgers. I've probably blocked about 500 people on social media because I have ads that run on Facebook and different Instagram for my book. I get so many people that love to chime in on the cover of this book because they automatically assume that they think they know what this is. So I get people to tell me, they say, oh, I disagree with you on Dr. Fauci. I go, disagree with what? Can you cite something from the book? he's mentioned three times in the book, and I don't say anything negative about him. I just painted the fact that that's it in the whole book. So people will come up and make up narratives in their own mind. It's the same people that were yelling 6 feet or whatever, as social distancing ambassadors, whatever you want to call them. Stay in your lane, folks. Worry about yourself. If you're so concerned, you know, it's the ones that got vaccinated because they wanted to protect themselves. And then they got so mad that you weren't vaccinated. It's like, well, why did you get vaccinated in the first place? You're protecting yourself. Now I'm the problem. They kept calling this the pandemic of the unvaccinated. This was the pandemic of the morons in this country. This was the pandemic of the uneducated. And I shouldn't say, when I say uneducated, I don't mean properly or classically educated, because a lot of these people who are overeducated study one thing in life and they don't have any common sense. When I say educated, I mean street smarts. I mean people with logic that understand basics bullshit, that particle size of mass, you know, that this cloth thing isn't helping me, that this 6 feet rule just seems stupid. No one is ever going to tell me that I can't see my loved one at a funeral or in a nursing home. All right. I'm going to find a way to figure that out. There is a certain segment of this population who kind of goes on with the flow because they don't like confrontation. They don't, you know, they just kind of, okay, I'll do whatever. And there's a certain set. What's that old saying, right? It's the 3% rule. It's the 97% of those work for the 3% of us who have never given up. Like you, you know, you go out on a limb, you're a leader, you do your own show. You're out here, you know, trying to bring relevant information out to people. You're in a very small percentage. Most of the world does not do that. So Rosie, you're sitting here trying to do big things. Most of the people are just kind of floating around, and don't get me wrong, they like to think they're doing big things, but will they ever stick their neck out and say, this doesn't make sense? And I'll say it, you know, at the risk of getting censored or canceled in this world. You can't cancel me, folks. Look, I'm not a medical doctor. Okay. You can't take away my license. I'm an analyst. I can sit and analyze data all day. And I got a couple medical certifications, but maybe I didn't have the fear of getting my license pulled, like some of the ones at America's Frontline Doctors. A lot of those folks, Simone Gold got her license pulled. For what? She was absolutely 100% correct in what she was saying the entire time. And it took the public 4 years to catch up with her. Is anybody going to make reparations to her, considering they screwed up her entire career during this thing? Is anybody going to go after help the doctors out who got fucked during this thing because they stuck their necks out to help people and tell them the truth? I mean, this whole thing it blows your mind. But the fact that people don't want to talk about it now because there was too much stress due to COVID and they want to move on, you've got to be kidding me, people. You said it at the beginning of the show, we're setting ourselves up for the next thing. And if we don't get on the same page about this thing, this is just going to be history that is written entirely wrong, that no one's going to have a clue as to what happened. But I will tell you this, in 100 years, the folks that come after us in generations are going to look back at us like we look back at the Hindenburg footage. They're going to laugh at the voices. They're going to laugh at what we did during this thing. They're going to say they did what to try to mitigate a pandemic. They're going to laugh at us, folks. Because we're acting like people that don't have a clue and don't have one shred of common sense.
But yet we were all know-it-alls. One of my favorite moments, Dr. Mike, and this is when I knew we were in trouble. I went to a local community board meeting. And I sat down, and because I had already agreed to testify, I'm like, oh man, I've been sort of like mitigating this whole COVID days without really wearing a mask, right? But now there's this woman who is really, she has a microphone and she was yelling at everyone, even if she saw you with just your nose. So picture this. I'm in a school auditorium. It is full of human beings. Everybody in there is either an elected official, a small business person, a community activist, nonprofit of some kind. My point is, people who make your neighborhood move in a certain direction. Mm. They were all complying. And the ones that dared to show their nose got yelled at by a little old lady who would scream at the top of their nose and be like, Dr. Mike, I see you. And like and embarrass you in front of a whole room of your peers. And when I saw that most people were acquiescing to her. This was the day that it was raining. It was like it was raining so much in New York City that it was, I think it was like from a hurricane. It was dropping. The water was dropped. I walked home for 20 minutes drenched because it with no umbrella, because I was so angry at what I had seen. Why? Because I'm like, how are these people that are supposed to be our local leaders? They're the ones acquiescing, pushing, and they don't even have the data.
Right.
And yet these same people, some of them, are in my DMs telling me to shut the F up. Stop making it so hard for yourself. Maybe you should just stay quiet. And one person celebrated all of our takedowns because we were poisoning the algorithm with misinformation. We were just kind of, we're not doctors. We were presenting inaccuracies, things that didn't make sense to us, and we were asking common sense questions.
I always ask the question when somebody has something to say, based on what? You know, we touched on that before. If you come to my office and ask me about cancer, we're going to send you to an oncologist. We don't do cancer. And we're not going to pretend to know. There's something called cognitive distortion. And it's funny. I've had a bunch of liberals, a bunch of left-wing loons. They like to throw the Dunning-Kruger effect around all the time. I don't even think they know what it means. The Dunning-Kruger effect has to do with cognitive distortion. It's funny. It's like the Saul Alinsky book. The person who's saying something is usually the one they're commenting on themselves. It's the oldest trick in politics. Call your opponent what you are and then have them defend it. So it's kind of funny to me when you have all these people out there trying to tell you, you know, what to do, but they don't have any basis for it. You should always ask them based on what. So if a doctor is telling you should get a shot, you should say based on what. You know, do you have experience with this? Have you treated COVID? Have you seen this? How much data do you have? And if you don't have the data, you should probably go to somebody else who does. I would have been yelling at that woman. I would have been yelling at that woman at the top of my lungs. I was, lady, zip it, because you have no idea what you're talking about. Based on what? If you have any scientific data to point out, do it. Otherwise, I'm going to give you mine and I'm gonna school the room on this. We really tried with politicians, but politicians want to acquiesce to those people because they're voters and they don't want to lose power and they don't want to lose money. And I get it, but it's not right. All right. I crave the day you're gonna have politicians stick their neck out. And you do have some of them. And I know Trump does it, and that's why a lot of people love Trump. And I hope to God we win this election, because if we go down this road and we continue to go down this road, whatever it is, we talk a lot about it on my show, and we don't talk about COVID a lot on my show at all. We talk about, you know, the border. Tonight we're gonna be talking about everything else under the sun. We do News Breakdown Wednesday. So we talk about everything that's going on today in the news, whether it's Hunter Biden or, you know, the vote that they had today on TikTok. This country has done a complete 180 from where we were the day Trump left office. And look at what we have now. And yet they still want to toe the line for these people. You could go to the grocery store and see $400 grocery carts, bills that would, you know, bury people. You buy a house with 7% interest rates, go to the gas pump and not complain. Yet they still want to toe the line for these people. You're never going to convince these people with common sense. They are cognitively distorted in their minds already. They have picked the narrative that they want to go with, and they're going to go with it until they die, until the end. They might get 500 boosters and throw a clot and die. They'll still on their headstone say, you know, I Joe Biden for president, or, you know, go out and, you know, stay 6 feet away from my gravestone. It's amazing to me. We as logical people always want to try to steer them with logic. We're always wanting to say, no, come on. Like, how do you not see it the way I see it? Let me paint a picture for you, and I want to help you. They don't want to be helped. They don't care. They don't care about you. They don't care about me. We're going about this all wrong. We're trying to deliver information out to people. When I wrote this book, I thought this was going to help people. I really thought that, because I was trying to write this for, I want to say, at least 2 years. My dad passed away in February of 23, which kind of put a hiccup in it. I released it in June of 23, but I could have had this out, you know, a couple of years earlier. It was just, we were seeing 100 patients a day. So it was really tough to get this information out. And now people want to come to me and say, well, hindsight's 2020. I'm on interviews, and this is the beautiful thing about doing shows like this. I was on a long form show, Cal DeReese Unleashed, in August of 21. Almost 3 years ago. doing a 2-hour interview. And everything that's in that book is on that interview. So we've been saying this for a very long time. There's no hindsight here. We predicted the mortality rate of COVID like 2 months into the pandemic. And we've said it was going to be between 0.01 and 0.02%, which the flu is 0.01%. Guess what? We're spot on. How did we know that? Because we have data. We can see trends. We're not stupid. And we just follow the logic. These people that want to argue with you, they don't want to be helped, Rosie. They don't care. They don't care about us. They don't care about the truth. They don't care. They're brainwashed to the point where I've lost faith in humanity. We need to stick together to make sure our people are educated, because they can still get, you know, this PCR thing is, it drives me nuts when I have it. No, you know, I don't mind doing it, but it drives me nuts because it's the one thing. Oh, the inventor says you should never. Yeah, I heard that interview too, but we've been using PCR testing to diagnose the flu for years before COVID existed. It's another one of the things on my respiratory pathogen. If they just saw the data like I saw it, they would get beyond that question. And we can move on to, how are we going to fix this country? How are we going to make sure that this never happens again? How do we make sure that our kids never have to be out of school? The suicide rates, like I mentioned, going up. That stuff is atrocious. That's the fact that we let that happen to our country. I question, again, my faith in humanity, because all of us should have the strength to stick together to push those morons away from us. You know, the 6-foot lady and the put your mask on and telling you what to do. No, enough. We're going to go do our thing. You guys do your thing. And eventually, you know, Darwinism will figure it out at some point.
Absolutely. A few more questions, if I may. How do you see it? You know, from your vantage point, something that I have a hard time sort of just resonating when I think about the years that the children have lost, not just in schooling, but, you know, in so many ways. I mean, I've heard data, I've seen data and I've heard statistics that do not feel good. But in all of this madness, another group that we don't speak about a lot is the children, the youth, the way they were affected, the ways their lives were just put on pause. What are your insights on that?
I don't think it's just COVID. I think COVID made it a lot worse. I think if you look at where, you know, we were when we were kids, you know, we'd go outside, we'd knock on our neighbor's door and say, hey, can Mark and Dave come out and play? Nowadays, they're, you know, video games in their basements, they're texting, they're afraid to have conversations with people. COVID made that 10 times worse. Kids need to see people's faces. They need to understand body language. They need to have interactions. And that's, you know, common sense. We all know that. But I think society as a whole is going down a road that really needs to change. I think parents need to encourage their kids to join sports or other groups, get out there, you know, do a podcast, talk to people. Even if it's this way, it's face to face. You can see somebody. Too many kids have crawled in a hole where they're just afraid to talk to people. What is going to transpire from that years down the road? Who knows? I'm not a psychologist. I do talk to people about it. I have talked to psychologists and psychiatrists about this. So it's funny you asked that question. I had a conversation about 2 weeks ago with somebody who's been doing this for 30 years. And he said he sees the effects every day in his office, dealing with these kids on a daily basis as a social worker, as a, you know, psychologist, talking to these kids. He sees the effects that the COVID lockdowns had on these kids. They don't really know how to communicate. And it's scary. So this is where we're going in the next couple generations. I wish I could answer that better. I can only tell you what other experts have told me, and they tell me it's scary.
Yeah, I, if I'm not mistaken, I interviewed somebody March 2021, and she said some of the things that you observed in your profession, where she's like, when 2020 hit, everybody got scared, and most people were seeing their patients from home. So they were doing online sessions. And her point of view was that she continued to see people face to face. And she was shocked that her colleagues really weren't doing that. And number two, she saw how hard that was, because that face to face, being in the presence of another human being, was very crucial, and that people needed that support too. And that, unfortunately, they were already seeing back in 2021 that there were people who were self-deleting themselves, right? Because these days, certain words trigger takedowns. You can't even say that word anymore. Depending on what channel you're on, they could take your video down. This is how ridiculous we are, people. We are learning how to do newspeak, and just so that we can have this subject, and just so that it could live in certain or on certain channels, because words hurt people these days, and political correctness is something that has been when I think about political correctness, the first place I think about is education in the way it's been pushed towards the children. And when I see some of the young people these days, there's less eye contact. So if we saw less eye contact before COVID, there's less eye contact now. There's more anxiety. The other day I went to a presentation where Jonathan Haidt was offering, he's a professor from NYU, and he was offering a seminar. And he just also wrote a book about, I gotta look for what the name is, but he was giving a presentation. One of the things that he was saying was that the children were already social distancing before 2019, to your point. We're not going outside. They're more indoors. And so we have got a problem, because if the adults are indoors and not really talking, then what kind of example are we serving for the youngsters? If you had a magic wand, Dr. Mike, what would you like to see unfold in this present moment?
Oh, I mean, we can go in so many different directions here. You brought up one point that I'll, on that question, and on all, because I know Kelly would have, she would like me to answer this at least. On the medical side, too many people are starting to go to urgent care now and stuff like that because of COVID, and they don't have a record of their health, which is not good. So go to a primary care doctor, get established on that, and make sure that you're not in and out. You're not just a number. You're a patient to somebody as far as health is concerned. If I had a magic wand in this political climate, a couple of things. I would abolish the tax code. I know we're getting political here, but income tax is progressive. It's regressive. It's stupid. It didn't exist until 1913. I'd abolish that and do a VAT tax that everybody pays, and then we could all be part of the conversation rather than just certain ones of us who work paying. I think we need term limits, because these people care more about their, they're getting reelected rather than, again, sticking their neck out, whether it's COVID or something else. Term limits is a push button issue for me. Maybe we need a balanced budget amendment in the Constitution. All that COVID money that you heard is getting clawed back. It's kind of funny, because I never got paid from any of the uninsured or underinsured tests that I did. We did thousands of them, and the CARES Act one day said, don't bill us anymore because we're out of money. And we're like, well, what do we do now? It's hundreds of thousands of dollars that we got screwed out of, which my landlord didn't say, well, you don't have to pay the rent for those months. And my staff didn't say, well, don't pay me for those months. I got screwed because the government screwed us. There's a lot of government interference in a lot of things. So I think a lot of what we need to change is government policy. I don't love social media, at least the way it's sitting right now. Trump was actively trying to stop this bill on TikTok that got passed this morning, because he didn't want, in his words, he didn't want Meta to be the, to have more power. And in that instance, I agree with him. I don't love TikTok. I don't have TikTok, but Meta controls what you hear. Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, it's not true. It's not a true, town square platform where people can have discussions when they pull down interviews that you do because they don't think it's right. Even if they find out it's right 4 years later, they don't sit and apologize to you. It's like when the person reads the headline on page 26, on page one, and then the retraction gets buried on page 26, 6 months later, they don't read the retraction and go, oh, they just remember the head. My mother still thinks there was Russian collusion in the 2016 election, even though that's been disproven a million times. My mother still has that in her mind, and that's what she'll talk about because she hates Trump and God, forbid. But those are her reasons. She doesn't understand the truth. So I think a lot of things need to change, but people need to be more diligent. They need to look at different avenues to get their news, whether it's shows like yours, maybe scour all the channels to figure out, how to read between the lines. I think people need to wake up. There's a very different. There's a huge difference between being woke and being awake. These people who claim to be woke, well, they've lost it. They're the brainwashed morons that I could care less about anymore. The people who are awake are the people that actually seek out interviews like this to say, what can I learn today about what I missed? Because I want to be educated. Those people are awake to the tyranny that's going on, to the, you know, the government overreaction, to the fact that our freedoms have been taken away systematically in a slowly but systematic way since the country was founded, but we don't realize it. We just, you know, we just kind of let things go because we say we like freedom, but we don't understand what freedom is. And we also want ease of use. We want to get through our day easily without having to deal. So if they say to do this, I'm just going to do this. Going back to the mask thing and the social distancing, I'm just going to go along with it because I don't want to, you know, upset the apple cart. We need to wake up, people. We need to start.
You know, you were out there being a danger to somebody's grandmother when you were not social distancing, Dr. Mike.
Well, I didn't lose one patient. So out of my 19,000 patients, 44,000. And by the way, a lot of my patients were in assisted livings and nursing homes, which we went through COVID testing these folks for 3 years. And didn't lose that. It was fun. And some of them would die of old age and stuff like that. But most of them, these folks that we saw in nursing homes were completely fine for the 3 years that we tested them. We got to know them very well. When those vaccines came out, one of the nursing homes that we worked with, the same week they vaccinated those patients, six of them threw clots. Three of them died. And the other three had strokes that were, you know, that some issues from within the same week of the vaccine. So, you know, to see it the way I see it, when you're working with patients day in and day out for 3 years and to see stuff like that, you go, okay, there's cause and correlation. These people don't want you to hear stories like that because it goes against their narrative. That's not only not fair. That's like, you know, there's a level of nefariousness there. If you think about it, there's some nefarious behavior there, and I would say it's sick and dangerous and be nice. It's scary to the point that these people, like, you know, if the death rate's going up amongst young people, when you have and I know I'm talking a lot here, I'm sorry.
No, I love this conversation.
When you have a life insurance company come out and say, we don't want to speculate, but we're just going to give you our data, and they tell you that they have an increase in deaths between ages 18 and 65, and that it's a 40% increase over what they usually see. Some people go, okay, what is 40%? It's huge. For that life insurance company to correlate that, they said it would be a 200-year event to see that kind of number. So when you see that right after the vaccines get released, you go, cause and correlation. So a guy like me looks at that and sees the trends, matching some of the trends we see with the patients and the nursing homes and assisted livings. And you go, this is just, there's something up here. You know, nobody ever wants to come out and say, you know, the conspiracy theorists, right? You start saying these words and use words like turbo cancer. I don't use that word because it's a conspiracy word. Do we see an abundance of cancer now that the vaccines are out? Yeah. Do we see an abundance of cancer in young people that are aggressive cancers that are coming out of nowhere? Absolutely. And you can talk to nurse after nurse on the ground in any area of the country, and they will tell you the exact same story, that they are seeing things that they have never seen before. But you will not hear it on the mainstream media. You'll only hear it on shows like this that get pulled down because they don't say it. It matches their narrative. It's really scary if you think about it. What do young people need to do? We need to wake up. That's the best way I can say it, but this is a scary time we live in. Now, by the way,
and my message to the young people, like the ones that are outspoken, keep on speaking because you are reaching people. And I know that some of the adults, we've done a great disservice to your generations, but we do need the young people, your fire, your wisdom, to be here on this fight with all of us on the front lines. Because, you know, Dr. Mike, one of the things that motivated me, no matter what was happening in my personal life, no matter that we had to close our business down because we couldn't keep up with the mandates. You know, we lost contracts. We got censored and booted off. And, you know, what happened to a lot of people who spoke out? You started kind of losing the community that you thought you were a part of, that maybe you served so much and you thought that they valued your work. But all of a sudden you have a different viewpoint of how you're seeing something, and people are looking at you like you're a demon and you're a devil, and you're poisoning everybody with even just your questions. I, to this day, have a really hard time even forgiving the fact that the Pope told people, and people who were religious leaders advised people to take a shot, the COVID shot. You know, I'm wearing a shirt, bring back God, right now. You can't really see, bring back God. It was my faith in God, and I'm speaking for my sister too, on behalf of my sister, because we had a spiritual wellness shop in Brooklyn, and we were getting all sorts of folks, old people, young people. And one of my alarming conversations was when I had a 15-year-old come in when we were closed. We were just working quietly on one of our off days at the shop. And the young lady was like, I didn't know where else to go. I have so much anxiety. I don't know how to control it in my body. And then her brother came with her to support. And he looked at me. He goes, we know that you guys have been here for all of these years. And we just felt like we could trust you and talk to you. My sister's having thoughts about deleting herself. We're not therapists. We're not psychologists. But what was happening is that God was calling people to step up. And so all I could do was give her love and words of encouragement and wisdom. But that was the kind of stuff that we were seeing, just an amplified anxiety in people that hasn't left many, have not left many. So they motivate me. They are the reason that I get up every day, is because I ask myself, what kind of world do I want to say I try to fight for? And I want to go, when God decides it's my last day, I want to know that I went in peace and that I tried my best with the tools and information that I had to bring these messages out there, to find people like yourselves, lions, who are doing this work, because it takes courage. It takes big courage to speak out during a time of this type of darkness, where there were so many layers that wasn't right. I loved the subtitle of your book, Fauci's Fiction, about all the things that went wrong from day one. As we wind down the interview, can you remind the community members where they can find your book and plug your future one, and also your show?
Yeah, well, God bless you, Rose Angel, for doing that. And I know you're an angel to people like that in the community, and you're doing good work. So keep up the good work. And, you know, I'm glad, you know, there are people like you that other people can rely on. Not just my book. I don't know the guy. But you mentioned Jonathan Haidt, and I looked it up for you. It's called The Anxious Generation. And that's coming out this month. You can pre-order it now. But he's got a bunch of books out. I looked that up for you, too, while we were doing the show. So that's what I'm used to doing my show. My show is Two Mics Live. It's on Rumble. It's myself, Mike Calderese, and Kelly. And we are live every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. We talk about a lot. Tonight is News Breakdown Wednesday. We're going to break down the news of the week. So Two Mics Live on Rumble. Check us out. The book is available everywhere you can get books. If you search it and you search like COVID book by Dr. Mike, you're not going to find it, because that's how the algorithms screw you around. You have to type in the words Fauci's Fiction or Fauci's Fiction book, and you will find it. Amazon's the easiest place to do it. I would ask your audience, anybody listening, if you enjoyed this interview, if you could go up and give me a book review on Amazon. You will help fight the one-star people who've never read the book, who just don't like it because of the cover, and I have to deal with that. So, of course, I want to sell books. I think it's $16.99 on Amazon, but there's a lot of information in there. Second book will be out June of 2024, God willing. I got a couple more interviews. One is with Dr. Jancy Lindsay tomorrow. She's a microbiologist. So you're going to hear all about what's in these vaccines that you never heard of, amongst other stories. So check out Fauci's Fiction, and then check out Vaccine Fiction in June. And you are a pleasure. I'm happy to come on anytime. We'll talk about whatever you want to talk about.
I'm really grateful. Here's the one question I do have. What time is your show? I don't know if you mentioned what the time.
7 p.m. 7 p.m. to roughly 8:30. Yeah, we're live. And we talk to the audience. So like, if you want to come on the show, we have open mic Friday. But if you come on and in the chat, we do talk to the audience and take questions. And then on Friday, we put the link to StreamYard in the show. So Rosie, if you want to come on the show on Friday and say hello to our audience, you're welcome to do so. I'll send you the link and you can pop in and say hi, promote your show.
Oh, I love that. Thank you. And you have an open invitation to Cafecito Break. We're also planning on doing New York Stands Together town halls. I mean, I know that you represent Jersey. I'm not, that's our neighbor. I was going to say, I also know that you are a Yankee fan, and it's okay. I don't hate Yankee fans, even though I've never stepped foot in Yankee Stadium, because I used to be a diehard Mets fan. So out of principle, I never stepped foot in Yankee Stadium, but I appreciate the New York vibe.
Boy, I'll let you slide on that one.
It's okay. You know, I have to say, Dr. Mike, my father grew up watching a little girl like me argue, debate his friends who were big baseball fans. He goes, "You Yankees and Mets fans, you're the most terrible kind of fanatics I've ever seen in my life." So that was just a dig, because I saw you wearing a Yankee fan in a Yankee shirt in one of your interviews.
I still play. So I run the Yankee tournament team down in Tampa, and I do all the
tennis and
everything. So I'm still, I'm actually a Yankee fantasy camp Hall of Famer. So it tells you how much I, you know, pay attention. I don't even care about the big team anymore. I care about like our camp teams and stuff, but maybe we'll get you to Tampa one day and we can convert you.
You might be able to convert me. I will say the Yankee uniform is classic, and there's nothing like the pinstripes. Excuse me. I was going to say pinstripes, but maybe there's a pun intended there with the baseball players sometimes. But no, that was just me being facetious. I don't hate baseball, any baseball team. It's just the competitive spirit in me.
I get it. I'm with you, and I appreciate it. I love it. Go Yanks. Mets. What does the Mets stand for? Must end the season, right?
Oh man. Well, listen. What have I'm the crazy. Mets done? They haven't gone anywhere much lately. So if a New York team represents New York, I'll still support.
We're just sad. We had a horrible season last year, and you guys were supposed to be your year with all that money spent, and then it just went downhill. So we'll see. We got friendly competition this year. We'll see who wins head to head, and then maybe we'll have a Mets versus Yankees show, and we can come on and debate.
Oh, I'll lose that debate. I'm rusty, but I appreciate it. Well, hopefully I'll see you on a Friday. You have an open invitation to Cafecito Break. And as I was saying, we're going to be doing New York Stands Together Town Hall with New Yorkers and fellow freedom fighters and people who are boots on the ground like yourself. And I'll let you know when those happen and you have an open invite too.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Thank you, mi gente. This is Dr. Michael J. Schwartz, and you can visit his page on michaeljschwartz.com, learn more about him, and please support people like Dr. Michael Schwartz, who are, you know, he's a busy man, and it takes a long time to write a book like this, especially so full with data. And it's also a good way to support those of us who are on the front lines, trying to, you know, bridge the gap and bridge the divide and try to have this really open conversation about everything that we've been living. So thank you again, Dr. Mike. Much success to you, to this book, to your career, and the new book that's coming out. And I predict that we'll have a part two on that one.
You got it. My pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you. This has been Rosangel Perez of Cafecito Break. We'll see you soon, mi gente.